Hi, this is Mick Turner. Hi, I'm Mick Turner from Dirty 3, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. And you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
Welcome to another episode of The Environment in Canada podcast, a podcast by Sierra Club Canada about the environment in Canada. Today we're going to be delving into the issue of the recent Alberta energy grid issues that happened, among other times, this week. And we're going to be talking with two guests about the statements and claims being made around those issues, namely that renewables were to blame for the issues experienced recently in Alberta, and also the idea that clean energy regulations might cause for harm to grids in Canada. We're going to be talking to Jason Wong with the Pembina Institute and Mitchell Beer of The Energy Mix. Jason is a senior analyst working on the Pembina Institute's electricity program based in Alberta. Mitchell is founding publisher and managing editor of The Energy Mix. We will also be diving in to talk a little bit about media coverage of environmental issues, including this one, and why we need to be asking some hard questions of claims being made, and hopefully the media will be asking those too. We hope you enjoyed today's podcast. I'm going to dive straight into the content. But that being said, if you are interested in learning more about Sierra Club, join us at sierraclub.ca. Make sure to take action on one of our action items or just find out more. You can also find us on social media on many platforms. And you can now find this podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. Hi, Jason and Mitchell. Thank you for joining me today. For those tuning in, can you briefly describe who you work for and what it is that you do?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me. My name's Jason Wong. I'm a senior analyst at the Pembina Institute. We're a national clean energy think tank and nonprofit proudly headquartered in Alberta. So I work on our electricity program. And essentially that means looking at things all the way from generation to transmission to distribution of electricity. And how do we make that cleaner and affordable and reliable for folks?
Thanks for having me. I'm Mitchell Beer. I'm the publisher of The Energy Mix, which is a community news site, a nonprofit community news site, a digest series on climate change, energy, and the shift off carbon. We've been publishing from Ottawa for nearly 10 years. And last year, we launched a weekly feature digest that we're calling Heat and Power that deals with all matters having to do with shifting the electricity grid and shifting heat from fossil fuels to clean electricity.
Wow, that really interesting work. And for today's sort of topic, we're jumping a bit into, you know, something you both either cover or deal with on a very regular basis. We're in a world that's increasingly relying upon renewable energy. And we just had the UN climate talks, of course, recently that have us now kind of declaring a transition away from fossil fuels, which means, as a result, an increased reliance on renewable energy. I'm curious, there's a lot of concern right now about what's happened with the Alberta energy grid in cold temperatures, and there's a lot of claims being made that renewables are to blame and that they can't be relied upon, and that creating grids that are going to be even more based on renewables would be dangerous. What's your take on this?
Yeah, I can get started on this. So I think the most important thing, you know, listeners should know about electricity grids and reliability is that the most important aspect is flexibility. It's not actually about, you know, necessarily the type of generation or anything else. It's just about flexibility. How do you run an electricity system where, you know, if one type of asset becomes unavailable, something else can fill the gap, right? So when we think about electricity reliability and potential grid issues, that's the main question that we start with. And, you know, looking back to Alberta's grid alerts in this past weekend, flexibility is the main thing that comes up. And we realize the grid is quite inflexible in many ways. And happy to dive into all of those. So basically, I want to start with Alberta is a bit of an electricity island in that we do have connections to other provinces, but very uniquely, we have very small connections to other provinces. So there's very limited ability to have basically electricity trade. You know, you saw on social media that Premier Scott Moe was saying that Saskatchewan is happy to help Alberta out in providing electricity, but that connection is actually quite small, about the size of like a very, very small gas plant or, you know, a medium-sized solar farm. But like, of course, that was available. We were very thankful for it. But overall, Alberta doesn't really have that much ability to call upon our neighbors for help. The second, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's not something that had been covered a lot, but please go ahead.
It's not what we've been hearing out of the out of most of the coverage, and simply not out of those two governments, no.
Yeah, and again, like, honestly, you know, as an Albertan, I'm very happy that, you know, Saskatchewan, Montana, and British Columbia all were able to provide us some electricity. But yeah, the truth is there isn't that much flexibility. It's great, but if we had more interties, we certainly would have a much more flexible system like BC and Pacific Northwest does.
Hmm. The point about flexibility I find so interesting on a couple of grounds. One is that the islanded nature of Alberta's deregulated grid that you described, Jason, as soon as I began hearing what was going on, it took me 3 years back to when the grid in Texas crashed under winter storm Uri, I believe in February 2021. Mm-hmm. In the initial reports were that 243 people died. By the end, the count was in the range of a bit 700. About half of the state of Texas, the one that you're not supposed to mess with, was under boil water advisories. Take it as given, racialized communities were hit first and worst. And it was because, hey, we're Texas. We don't need anyone's help. We're ERCOT. We're not going to, the Electricity Reliability Council of Texas, we're not going to connect with any of those other grids out there. That would be socialism. Well, this isn't to advocate for socialism, but it is certainly to advocate for grids do better when they can share them and pool the resources they have available to them. And as you say, Jason, get as much flexibility into the system as possible. It's got to be more than a decade ago now that the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in the United States first modeled how first all of the United States and then all of North America could run 24/7 every day of the year, no matter what, on clean renewables, as long as grids could share power back and forth. And the technical details and the political details of getting that done were a lot more complicated. But the simple answer was, sure, the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow all the time, but those things are going to be happening somewhere. And now when you add battery storage, which you were saying, Jason, in one news interview, battery and storage stepped up for the first time ever and helped solve this crisis last week. With batteries, the energy analysis just gets so much better 10 and 12 years later.
I'm curious, Jason, what's your take on that and storage and like batteries and renewables in this crisis, but maybe in future ones as well?
Yeah, I definitely want to come back to that idea of, you know, what is a future grid and what does it look like? You know, why did NREL do this study and like what kind of world does that put us in? But I think that's like an awesome other conversation just on storage. So Alberta basically has been slowly building up energy storage facilities, mostly now batteries, like recently batteries. Just in the fall, one Calgary-based company, Enfinit, just installed a couple of new battery plants, and they came online. And these facilities helped us out. They bought us quite a few hours over the weekend in being able to provide that flexibility that you know we've been talking about, to buy us a few more hours where we didn't need to send out a grid alert or send out, you know, a message to every Albertan's mm-hmm. phones and TVs telling us about the grid situation. The economics of storage actually aren't great in Alberta at the moment, and that's partly because our government regulations don't fully recognize the roles that storage can play on the grid by providing services exactly like it did. this past weekend. And the system operator and the government actually already know about these issues and about the potential that storage has. It passed a bill in May 2022 that would allow the system operator to be able to, you know, to take some more steps and modernize its regulations and allow storage to really, you know, really shine. But that bill, it received royal assent, but it hasn't been proclaimed. Like, I didn't actually know there was this other step in our process, in our legislative process, until this bill, to be honest. Clearly need to go back to high school. But yeah, the lieutenant governor signed it, but the government needs to do one more step and proclaim it for it to be fully enforced.
But you had one job, right? And this is why we can't have many things. I think it's really important to background one aspect of what you just said, and that is that any grid operator anywhere knows, certainly down to the half hour, maybe down to the minute, when they can most likely expect to hit peak load, you know, and then an event like this comes along and it throws all those calculations up, because I gather in Alberta for the last week, you had, you know, record demand because of the cold snap. But for the most part, grid planning is all about anticipating those highs. And that peak load will be the most expensive power for various reasons. It's also the point where you look first to see what you can replace, what you can offset, whether it's with energy efficiency, whether it's with other sources of supply, whether it's with storage. So one of the strongest arguments for batteries and one of the best uses is to store the power at 2 a.m. when demand is lower, and then use it when demand is highest to shave down that peak so that you don't have to start up the gas plant, or so that you don't have to build new gas capacity in the first place when you know it's a methane bomb and we're in a climate emergency, right? So the fact that, you know, what got me on this track is when you pointed out that battery capacity saved Alberta several hours, in the context of a system that plans by the minute and by the half hour, that's huge. You know, in this context, it might not have been enough, but I'm, you know, it's brilliant that a province now has that capacity. And that's not the end. I have to assume that's just the end of the beginning. And this is the direction we need to be going.
Go ahead, Jason.
Yeah, in my role, you know, we at our think tank, you know, we do research, we do advocacy. We're definitely trying to work with government in highlighting that more storage is beneficial for many reasons, not just, you know, in situations like this past weekend. But yeah, there are these huge opportunities and we should be taking advantage of them. Like you said, the grid is remarkably predictable. Wind and solar generation are remarkably predictable. Like, even though our weather forecasts aren't right all the time, we're actually really good at knowing when there won't be sun and when wind power is not going to be as online as, you know, as it could be.
Well, and I guess that ties a bit into my next question, was on the clean energy regulations and the question that's been in a lot of people's minds, I imagine, because it's being raised, will that harm grids like those in Alberta and Saskatchewan?
Yeah, I think if I could back up a quick step to the last question, one other form of flexibility is just, what do you have available to produce electricity? Like, could it be another gas plant? And, you know, last weekend in Alberta, we had a few gas plants that were out for maintenance, planned maintenance, which was quite surprising because we knew that there was potentially going to be a supply crunch. So one action that could have been taken is to say, hey, can you delay your maintenance maybe by a week or 2 weeks? Definitely recognizing it's tough to move outages, but this might have been a situation that called for it. And then there were two gas plants that were heavily affected by temperatures as well. So our system's not as vulnerable as Texas's system, but there were two plants that either went offline or reduced their output significantly because of the extreme cold. And that led to, you know, the real crunch that we had. Like, before that happened, the system operator didn't actually think we were going to be in a supply crunch situation or need a grid alert. It kind of happened very last minute. So having more gas plants, you know, to be honest, would have been one part of one way to add flexibility. It's not the cheapest way. It's not the best way for emissions, but you know, it's the same with storage, right? It's the same with any source of asset. If we simply had more, that could have led to flexibility. And Alberta often brings up that the clean electricity regulations harms our ability to build more gas generation, but we're actually seeing tremendous growth in that sector. By 2026, just within 2 years, we're actually going to see gas capacity in Alberta expand by 24%, which is huge, to put in simple terms. So many of those gas plants are going to be able to operate for many years, well past 2035. And, you know, the clean electricity regulations don't actually, you know, they're not going to force those plants to shut down. They have tremendous flexibility that's going to allow those plants and older plants to continue to be able to run. But they do send a strong signal to those gas plant operators that, hey, you should be thinking about how to get your emissions to zero. There are approaches, especially ones that gas companies have been, you know, lauding for years: carbon capture, hydrogen, many different approaches. And you know, I think 2035 is really just the beginning, right? Most of these companies have between 2035 and 2045 to transition their gas plants. So, in our view at Pembina, the clean electricity regulations provide a lot of certainty for these gas plant facilities. They're not going to, like, yeah, I would say, to put it simply, they're not going to harm our grids. Our grids, like I said, or like we discussed in the last question, there's a lot more to it, right? There's flexibility that we have to talk about, and the clean electricity regulations on generation, that's only just one part of flexibility. There's all these other things too.
It falls outside of, you know, there's the debate, obviously, about should we be building more gas plants. And, you know, on behalf of Sierra Club Canada, I can say we're not in favor of that. But even if you are in favor of that, like, there's this reality that these regulations, it seems like, don't really impact it one way or the other. Mitchell, go ahead.
I mean, I think with any aspect of the transition of carbon, there's always an important and interesting and complicated and granular conversation about, we know where we need to get to, we know that we're behind schedule, and we're you know, playing catch up on the defining issue of our lifetimes and the defining challenge of our lifetimes, and we're not going to, any of us ever going to want to do that in a way that drives energy prices through the roof or puts anyone in the position of ever having to wonder whether electricity will be there for them when they want it. Which is a roundabout, longabout's way of saying affordability and reliability. Every time I hear what I know has been the really hard work and long work, and I'm not going to say good work only because I wasn't in the room, so I didn't witness that, but I gather really good work on that regulation. When I hear all of that just reduced to a sensationalized soundbite, every time I see that, what I think back to is the stories that we and others published when the regulation was first released in August. Our headline was, gas plants will still be allowed. You know, if this potentially transformative piece of regulation, it is a cornerstone of the effort to get Canada's climate pollution under control. It's a part of an effort that we're now hearing is within reach of actually being able to hit the country's 2030 climate target and a few megatons ahead of the interim target for 2026. And I don't know if either of you saw that coming. I didn't see that coming. What, Canada makes its climate target? What world are we living in? That never happens. Apparently it's about to. The regulation is one part of that. I mean, it takes effect in 2035, but it's one part of that broader push. And to just trivialize it down to, you're attacking us, when it's not true, and there's so much more context, it's you know, to tell you how I really feel. It's frustrating because it makes good sound bites, it makes for good headlines. We're a news outlet, we should be ecstatic. But this fight, this effort is already complicated enough, and we don't need to be making it a couple of orders of magnitude more complicated with, you know, sort of fabricated interprovincial battles that are about nothing and can easily tie down months or years that we don't have.
Oh, it's something too, you know, and this comes up with some with other policies that a lot of activists put a lot of time into advocating for, a lot of, you know, supporters. I know so many people from, you know, our supporter base who have spent their time sending in submissions to government calling for this, often on uphill battles, by the way, that, you know, were not necessarily things that we thought, you know, we were going to get in policy. It is frustrating to see the public debate sort of come down to those headlines as opposed to maybe the more complex. Like, again, I didn't know anything about the flexibility of the grid system was not something that was brought up. Still, that's not something that I saw. What's your take on the way that, you know, media is sort of covering this story? And, you know, you've already answered this a bit, Mitchell, but glad to jump more in. You know, Jason, do you want to start us off on that?
Yeah, sure. I can say, you know, related again to the last question, the government of Alberta and Saskatchewan, they have been saying things like, you know, the clean electricity regulations will harm the system. They're saying, you know, renewables harm electricity. And again, I don't think that's the right framing, right? But a key thing is they haven't actually been showing their work. They haven't released reports that we know exist.
You can't show your work when there is none. Sorry to interrupt.
Well, actually, on the clean electricity regulations one, we do know that there was a public procurement for a consultant to do some analysis, and that analysis has never been released. You know, I shouldn't really speculate as to why it hasn't been released, but what we've done at the Pembina Institute, the analysis that we've done, and the independent work we've seen from some other folks has been basically saying the same thing: a diverse grid with many different types of assets, with a lot of wind and solar, is the cheapest way to affordability, to reducing emissions, and to reliability. And of course, with interties and batteries, I should make sure I say that. But you know, there's a lot of work. It seems like I don't want to say consensus because we're not able to do, you know, thousands of reports, but certainly. There's a majority agreement that, you know, the grid needs more renewables, right? And that, it is a bit counter to what the government has been saying. And I do think that within the media conversation, I do wish that the government was asked more of, can you really substantiate this claim? Like, why are you claiming this thing? We know that the wind isn't going to blow. We will have flexibility in other ways. And I have to be honest, Mitchell, I haven't read your pieces on this yet. I've just been, you know, drowning in the event.
It's 9 a.m. your time. I'm deeply offended. And no one has time to read. So
I've read it actually, by the way, Mitchell, this morning. And just to...
Yeah,
to
you're in the Eastern time zone, you Easterners, right?
Website. You should go check it out if you're listening in. So,
yeah, the Energy Mix. Great outlet.
But just to the point that you were making about, you know, that fascinating study that must have made great in-house reading for the people in the Alberta government, and it was so good they didn't want to share it. We're seeing, and then the always excellent analysis that you did at Pembina. We've been seeing the same elsewhere as well. I believe it was last year. No, we've just changed here. I think it was 2022. Clean Energy Canada came out with a study that showed that then renewables were cheaper than new gas plants in Alberta and Ontario, and that solar was on its way into about a 40% price drop. And as well, Ontario's been dealing with a lot of the same issues. There's a massive and arguably unnecessary build out going on right now of both gas peaker plants and refurbished nuclear capacity. And there was a study that was done for Ontario's independent electricity system operator that showed that distributed energy resources could clear the entire electricity backlog in Ontario, electricity shortfall in Ontario that's been projected and that we're right on the cusp of, that was brought about in large part, by the way, by the Ontario government summarily canceling 758 signed contracts for renewable energy development, many of them in Indigenous communities, and then taking a finished wind farm that was ready to roll. It was built, it was ready to go into operation, and ripped a living, breathing wind farm out of the ground. Now, Ontario's policies have been shifting recently, you know, and that's fantastic. But I was glad to see, speaking of media coverage, one columnist in the Toronto Star saying, yes, this is fabulous, and it doesn't offset the damage, you know. So when you go to the evidence, when you go to the research, the options that also get us lower carbon emissions, that also decarbonize the grid at a time when we absolutely need to, also get us the affordability and the reliability and the flexibility and the resilience against unpredictable climate disasters that the rest of us, that everybody wants, and that for people outside the climate bubble are probably in the final analysis more important than the emission reductions. If a household is routinely having to choose between food and fuel, what's going to be more important to them? We've just done something to cut your emissions. Everything's going to be okay. I apologize for parodying us, but we've all done that at one time or another, right? Versus, you won't have to make that choice anymore because your power bill is going down, not up. No, no, no. Pick yourself up off the floor. We mean it. Your power bills are about to go down. And by the way, it's even better. We cut emissions. That's the co-benefit.
Yeah, absolutely. Our work at Pembina has found that a clean grid by 2035 could save households up to $600 per year on their electricity. Wow. And that's basically because renewables are fuel-saving technologies. I'll say just additional background on what you said, Mitchell. The Clean Energy Canada report about renewables and their cost compared to gas, they actually found with storage linked to the project, it would still be cheaper than gas. In the Ontario recent procurements for both gas and storage, we actually saw, like, you know, directly on paper in this procurement process, bids for storage, like over an amount of time to supply electricity, like over the project lifetime, basically, can deliver electricity for cheaper than gas plants. Like the bids all came in cheaper than gas. You know, this was not just theory anymore. Like, we saw it in Ontario, and I think the Ontario government also saw that. Yeah.
It's happening before our eyes. And let's just pause on that. You know, this is one of those moments when I love playing the dinosaur, and I hope it's useful, because when I think back to the 3.5 years that I spent at Canadian Renewable Energy News in the late 1970s, early 1980s, this conversation wasn't even science fiction yet. It wouldn't have been possible. The terminology wasn't there. About 10 or a dozen years ago, when I was brought onto the first phase of a modeling project to try to figure out how Canada could get to 2050, at some point I don't remember it being conscious, but we made a tacit decision that we weren't going to include anything in our inventory of the clean energy that we thought would be available to Canada by 2050. We weren't going to include anything that we weren't reasonably confident would be ready for prime time by 2030. Okay. Because, and you know, again, I mean, there's never any conversation about it, but that made sense to me, because if you count on something for 2030, hello, carbon capture, and then it can't deliver, there won't be time to make up for that, which means you won't make your target without really even more heroic efforts. So going back to the sort of early part of the 2010s, we included onshore but not offshore wind, because offshore wind looked too expensive. And of course, now, I mean, except for a brief dip right now, offshore wind is killing it. And batteries? What batteries? Grid batteries? What's that? There, again, was barely any vocabulary for that 10 or a dozen years ago. So take that pace of change, make it just a little bit exponential, because that's the way things are going. And tell me again why anybody wants to invest in a gas peaker plant for the next 30 years. Or 20 years or 15 years? Nuts. From a business point of view, never mind a climate point of view. And in that basis, we already know that it's nuts.
So, go ahead.
I've one other thing I want to say about the media. I think a question that governments should continually be asked is, the world is changing at a tremendous pace. What are you doing to plan for it? How are you going to enable, you know, these other technologies that other jurisdictions are implementing? If you're saying that, you know, some type of technology isn't working, can you show us your math and show us your plan to deal with this? Show us how you plan to stay competitive, right? And Yeah, like I think Mitchell gave some great examples in the Ontario context. The distributed energy resources study was huge, said something I think nobody really, because it's sort of been ignored, that sector. But I think many of us watching didn't realize how much potential distributed energy resources really had. And I think the government heard that message similarly, that it can supply basically all of the supply shortage the province is going to have. And then, you know, in Alberta, you know, we sure, like, we can talk about many different types of generation, but why are you ignoring the cheapest forms of generation? Why haven't you proclaimed this bill to enable what you already know? Keep talking about interties. What are you doing about it? And what is your plan for 2035 if it's not net zero? Like, we need more than just, you know, we're doing something, we're working with industry. We need a little bit more than that, because the scale of the changes that we are seeing and need to see, not just to meet emissions targets, but also to keep up with the rest of the world, the scale of change that we need really needs coordinated efforts between the government and industry and, you know, the system operators and electricity users.
Yeah. And yeah, since you're reminding us, this was originally a question about media coverage. I think what I'd say about that is that on one hand, I would say news coverage of climate and energy transition has been improving by orders of magnitude from what I can see over the last 2, 3, maybe 5 years. My favorite example, although it's not Canadian, is that about a little over a year ago now, The Washington Post announced, in the midst of wider layoffs in the newsroom, because of course, you know, journalism's in deep crisis to this day, they announced that they were expanding their climate desk to more than 30 reporters, which is just absolutely mind-blowing. And they were doing really good work before that. They're doing amazing work now, and it's really interesting seeing some familiar names pop up at places like The Washington Post, The New York Times, reporters who had sort of been working for smaller climate media. Sabrina Shankman at the Globe and Mail, at the Boston Globe, rather, I'm sorry, you know, seeing people move into these, you know, daily newspaper spots. But I think there is a challenge that news needs to grapple with. And it really came crashing home to me in September. I was really fortunate that I got to cover or attend a conference called Climate Change is Everything, which was hosted by the Covering Climate Now News Collaborative, the Solutions Journalism Network, and the Columbia University School of Journalism. And one of the session moderators said, I report to 8 million people. This was a TV journalist. There were 200 of us in the room who were basically doing climate news coverage every day, you know, which is in itself a milestone. But he said, it's an audience of 8 million people. I can't drill down to the specifics. I can't get too technical. And that's absolutely right. You know, so I absolutely agree that general news coverage needs to go deeper, that questions from general news reporters or specialists working for general media need to get a lot more incisive. And it's a struggle. Before you explain the answer that came back from the Alberta government on why we don't have more interties, you need to do a background on what an intertie is. Not because people are dumb, but because people are busy living their lives. And you have to be inside the bubble to know what an intertie is, unless you have some other reason to know that. It's fascinating stuff, but it takes time to learn. So I'm curious to see how the profession is going to deal with that over the next few years. We need to. And in this and so many other subject areas, stay tuned, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that dives into, like, you know, it's funny, you're thinking, you're saying about the, you know, potentially $600 a year cost savings. And I'm thinking to myself, well, that's a lot of rent for a month gone.
It's a good place to start.
And it's a question. Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead, Mitchell.
Yeah, actually, sorry. Just a quick pursuit on that, just about, you know, sort of conveying the cost and the cost savings aspect of this. This isn't about the grid system, but in the last few weeks, couple of months since the announcement in late October about the carbon price carve out in the Atlantic, there's been a lot of conversation, a lot of concern that the federal government has really honestly done such an awful job of communicating the reality that the large majority of us receive more back in our carbon price rebates than we pay out as a result of the carbon tax. It was a really pleasant surprise to open my email a few days ago and see not just a story, but a lead story on CBC about how people in four provinces were getting their rebates back today, and here's how much you might expect to get. I think that partly plays to the role of different organizations in Climate Action Network, including Sierra Club Canada and including Pembina, in hammering away at those issues, hammering away to your media contact and saying, people don't realize. In this case, this story isn't being told. It's not your fault. It's not being, yeah, you're not getting the info, but it's out there and it's essential. It will determine national policy, you know, that one misunderstanding. So it's possible to get this information out in exactly the way you just articulated it, Jason. The average household saves $600 a year. Let's talk.
I think that's something that, there's also a conversation, because we're hearing a lot in the last few minutes of us talking about actually all the ways renewables have this great potential to help balance out energy grids, to help, you know, allow us to exchange energy and help us store energy, things like battery storage. Is there a way to do that, do you feel, that not only increases the interconnectedness of different places, but also gives communities maybe more say in their own energy mix and in sorry to use your brand there, Mitchell, the energy mix, but that actually gives
anytime
a, you know, personal maybe personal power over that, personal savings, but also something as a community that we can be doing?
That's always been a conversation in this round of the transition and in past rounds, and I'm not going to go full dinosaur again, but it's always been a conversation that, yes, you know, this is not just about trading out one crappy, corrupt, centralized, undemocratic energy system for another. It's about actually doing this better if we get it right. And I think the most immediate way to answer that is just with a pop quiz. Don't think twice, each of you, which jurisdiction in the, I'll say in the Northern Hemisphere, is closest on track to putting in the biggest virtual power plant in North America. So this would be battery capacity large enough to ensure local resilience in a disaster. So that's a hint. And minimize or eliminate the use of gas peaker plants. Which jurisdiction is on its way to having the biggest virtual power plant anywhere?
I'd say California. Okay.
Nope. No. A lot more. Puerto Rico.
Okay.
Where their grid was in such rough shape. They were so dysfunctional before Hurricane Maria came along and just took it all out. And devastated the whole area, devastated far beyond Puerto Rico as well. As I recall, it got as far as Atlantic Canada. And then, of course, like the grid had just no capacity to respond. So a year later, so many people were still without power. And the community said, okay, well, I think rooftop solar looks pretty good here. And gee, you know, would you like batteries with that? Well, yeah. Who has solar without batteries? Microgrids? Oh, sure. Tesla wants to help us with the microgrid. Okay. I guess that was in the days before Elon became Elon as we know him now. Mm-hmm. And in the end, I gather, according to a story that ran on Grist last week, this is building into a coordinated effort to use those local batteries as backup, as grid capacity. So the thing that, you know, what I was saying earlier about charging when demand is low and then using it when demand is high, that's reached a level of Puerto Rico that is on track. They're not there yet, but they're on track to exceed any other North American jurisdiction. And yes, I would have guessed California until I saw that story.
Well, we're running out of time a little bit, but a quick lightning round of questions on that. Jason, I'm curious your thoughts on that. And then also if you have any closing remarks on just maybe how renewables tie into climate change adaptation too. I mean, we saw a huge amount of wildfires last year. We're seeing extreme weather different changes during the winter. You know, we get flooding. I mean, I was in Yukon a few years ago when we had mass flooding. And so I'm curious, like, Jason, your take on the sort of energy, maybe localization question, and then maybe we'll just do a quick lightning round on that.
Yeah, well, I can give my quick lightning responses to those. And I want to sneak in one more just about economic benefits to municipalities. They've been huge, especially in Alberta. We've seen certain counties have over 50% of their municipal revenues come from like taxes paid by renewables projects. And many of these, actually, I can think of at least one very vocal one that said oil and gas payments have dried up, that these operators don't always pay. We were able to be financially sustainable as a county, as a municipality, because of renewables revenues. They allowed us to build like a hockey rink, I think, or at least upgraded hockey rink, upgrade roads and that kind of infrastructure. And one county, I think, is expecting those revenues to even go up to like 80%. And anyways, there's so many more stories to tell there, but local communities in Alberta are already benefiting even with grid-tied electricity. So just want to leave that with all of you. On the other ones, absolutely love the idea of distributed energy resources for generation, for democratization, for the resilience aspects. One type of technology I'm super excited about is induction stovetops with batteries attached to them. These are like, I think a lot of viewers or listeners might not know about induction stovetops, and they're basically like using really strong electromagnets to heat up your cooking pots instead of using like gas or radiation, like a lot of the glowing ones right now do. But they can cook really quickly. Like they can boil a giant pot of water in 30 seconds. It's incredible. People should know about induction stoves and how quickly they can boil water, because it's awesome. But the easiest way to allow it to do that and like not need any electrical upgrades or whatever is to put a battery into it. And if you put like an even moderately sized battery into it, suddenly you can back up your fridge, you can back up like all the lights in your house, and they're easy to install because they come in the same format that your like existing stove and oven already come in. They do ask you to, yeah. So I want to see more of those. Like, because they're so easy to install, and in the States, they qualify for investment tax credits through the Inflation Reduction Act, they're going to be cost competitive with like a new, you know, stovetop of any kind. So I'm very excited about those. I think their prices are going to come down. I think people are going to figure out soon that they can boil water for pasta in like seconds, and they're going to be very excited about that. And then it's going to bring all the other resiliency benefits.
And I love the way you framed that. The second best argument for that is that with enough of those induction stovetops, we are on our way to backing out a gas plant we thought we needed to build, or backing out a gas plant we already have and reducing emissions. That's the second best argument. The best argument, that was the third best. The second best argument is that with a battery on board, you'll be in better shape the next time the weather gets bad. The best argument is show your friends how you can cook pasta in 30 seconds, right? And we need all of us to get more proficient at sort of thinking through, it's not messaging, it's reality, and sort of thinking through how to frame that. I just want to compare and contrast a little bit what you're saying about counties that are already very happy with the municipal tax revenue that they're getting even from grid-tied renewables, because in the same province, as you know, Jason, there are so many municipalities that are in desperate condition because the fossil fuel companies that they have been depending on for municipal tax revenue haven't been paying up. The leaseholders, you know, who gave up parts of their farms or other land to these fossil fuel operations are not getting their lease payments, and it's in the hundreds of millions of dollars owed. So, you know, in our headlines, we've been calling them deadbeat fossils. You know, the not every single company, but the industry is sitting on record obscene profits. And last I heard, municipalities are still not getting that money. You know, so what does the Alberta government do? They, with no warning, no advance notice, they announced a 7-month moratorium on renewable energy development at a time when Alberta was leading the country in renewables deployment. And as you're pointing out, municipalities are doing just fine, thank you very much, on the essential, necessary tax revenue that helps cover the cost of services that Albertans depend on, And saying that we're operating in the interests of Albertans, we cut off that stream and do everything we can to prop up the deadbeat industry that isn't even paying its bills. I get that logic, don't you?
We certainly think that that industry needs more attention. and you know, if Alberta is concerned about the things it said it is for the renewables moratorium and inquiry, I think there are some other sectors, oil and gas for sure, but even just like open pit mines, like gravel mines, aggregate mines. This is something that rural municipalities have been actually talking about for years too, even before they talked about oil and gas facilities not paying up their taxes. There are quite a few of those issues. And you know, if we are to look at the issues named for the renewables moratorium, there are quite a few of those that the government of Alberta should be looking at too.
There's one other story we've been following as well, where a brilliant, brilliant pilot project trained a group of former oil sands workers, and quite a large proportion of this cohort were indigenous workers, to first of all remediate abandoned well sites and then to install solar on those sites. Abandoned and orphaned well sites are a really good, can be a really good location for community solar, because the roads and the electrical interconnections are already there. So, you know, whatever surrounding damage has been done has already been done. Let's use that as a resource now that we've got it. What it meant was that the nearby farmers who need electricity for irrigation, who are going to need more irrigation, because I hear tell that there's been a drought in Alberta, and I hear tell that it's being made worse and longer by climate change. Who knew? The electricity from those solar installations is exactly, or pretty much exactly, where those farm operators need and want it. So it's a win in all directions. It's jobs. It's supporting our farms. It, you know, farms feed cities, all of it. So you would think that a provincial government that wanted to, frankly, do well by doing good, or just do good, would look at that pilot and say, how do we amp this up? How do we scale this right now? Well, it turns out that provincial regulations prevent it, because provincial regulations are tilted in favor of the legacy gas provider or electricity provider. So last I heard, that project was still stalled, which is just a tragedy and yet another unforced error that we don't have time for.
Thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure to have you here.
It was fun. Thanks.
Thank you so much to Jason and Mitchell for joining me today. Before we end today's episode, I just want to do a quick answer to our very first Q&A of the series. This is a chance for listeners like you to write into us with your questions, and we will answer them at the end of the podcast. I just want to first clarify that all of our answers that we're giving here are only on behalf of Sierra Club Canada, not on behalf of our guests today on the podcast. This is just a chance for you to ask us directly what is being on your mind. We received a question about where we operate and where Sierra Club Canada operates and where Sierra Club operates. Just to clarify that, so there are actually three different Sierra Clubs. There's Sierra Club, quote unquote, which is the U.S. Sierra Club, and it operates throughout the United States, has a lot of local chapters. There is Sierra Club Canada, which is us. We operate in a lot of different places in Canada. We have four different regional chapters in Quebec, Ontario, Atlantic Canada, and the Prairies. And we also have a nationwide youth chapter. And then there is a third Sierra Club, Sierra Club BC, which operates in BC. And all three of the main Sierra Clubs are Sierra Club BC, Sierra Club US, and Sierra Club Canada are separate entities. We're all legally distinct, but we all work together when there's a chance to collaborate. So, for instance, on cross-border issues, which was a big topic of a recent event with the United States Sierra Club, and on issues that affect BC with Sierra Club BC. So that's an answer to that question. We've also been receiving in general a lot of questions about how to talk to people in your life who may have been exposed to things like misinformation. And there's a lot that you can do. Obviously, we know this is a very difficult subject for a lot of people. There is a lot that you can do. First of all, of course, is make sure you're taking care of yourself and that you have a supportive community of your own where you can go to chat with other people. Another thing, of course, is in general to help share content like this that helps get to, you know, the truth behind the issues of the environmental issues that we're dealing with. And then, you know, a third thing to keep in mind is that in talking with people in your life who may have differing views on climate change and environment or may have heard things that are factually incorrect, a good place to start is by finding common ground. You know, we all have concerns that we're concerned about. A lot of us are concerned about the cost of living right now, and that's a real and perfectly legitimate concern. And I think it's important to first sort of connect on that and then to discuss how, well, climate change is a major contributor to, for instance, things like the rise in the cost of living. It's something that is going to make that a lot worse in the future. It's something that's going to make a lot of other situations worse. So making sure that you're, you know, connecting with people first before just countering misinformation is important. Of course, staying up to date with resources that ourselves and other reliable sources are putting out on climate information issues, I think, is really important as well. I hope that you got something out of today's episode in that respect and to some of the other resources we've been putting out. And the other thing just to keep in mind is too, if you're really getting into debates with somebody where you can't change their mind on something, well, that may not be the person whose mind you can change, but that doesn't mean that there aren't other people out there who you can still have an honest discussion with and a good faith discussion with. And it's worth taking your time to spend with the people who you can have a good faith discussion with to try and help. But I recognize all of that is not easier said than done. Those are some places to start. Again, thank you so much to Jason and Mitchell for joining us on today's podcast. Please do tune in to our next podcast episode, and in the meantime, send us your Q&A questions. This has been an episode of the Environment in Canada podcast, a podcast about the environment in Canada by Sierra Club Canada. You can find us now on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and many other places you find your podcasts. And do be sure to check out our website, sierraclub.ca, with lots of actions you can take to help make a difference. You can also find us on social media on many different platforms. Stay tuned and take action.
Hi, I'm David Suzuki, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Information to grow the brain.
Mark your calendar every last Tuesday of the month and tune in to a special series of Soul Perspective on 90.3 FM.
Tuesday from 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m.
Broadcasting live from West Haven Community Center in NDG.
Tune in to a special series of Soul Perspectives on 90.3 FM.
This Tuesday, January the 30th, we have special guests Zoo 365 Fitness, Sita Gabriel,
and DJ TJ.
Last but not least, West Haven Teens and the After School Program will be blessing us with a special segment.
So, don't forget, tune in every last Tuesday of the month.
Soul Perspective, live from West Haven Community Center. Tune in.
See you then.
This is a West Haven and CQT co-presentation.
Black Theater Workshop presents the world premiere of Diggers by Donna Michelle St. Bernard. Abdul and Solomon introduce newbie Bai to the intricacies and dignity of grave digging. But when illness hits their town, they must make the best of a bad situation. Full of song, laughter, tears, and beautiful humanity, Diggers is a tribute to essential workers. Catch Diggers at the Siegel Center Studio from February 1st to the 17th. Get your tickets at siegelcenter.org or call 514-739-7944. More information at blacktheaterworkshop.ca. This is a Black Theater Workshop and Prairie Theater Exchange co-production and CKUT co-presentation.
Gem Art Center is pleased to present When Big Man Talk, the exhibit. Come experience a captivating fusion of paintings, photography, an immersive virtual reality experience and more. To kick off the exhibit, JAM Arts is presenting the film African Redemption, The Life and Legacy of Marcus Garvey, screening January 31st at 7 p.m. at the Maison de la Culture Côte des Neiges. Then experience When Big Men Talk, the exhibit, from February 3 to 10 at Galerie Lucie Michel, and after that from February 11 to 14 at the UNIA. For tickets, call 438-507-9258 or head to jam-montreal.com and click JAM Arts Center.
Here, have a seat. I wanna tell a story. There are many things I'd like to share about the girl who knows me. Met her on a Saturday. We hung out on Sunday. Felt like we've been friends forever. Damn, I can't explain. Maybe it's her attitude. Maybe it's her smile. Maybe it's her luscious lips. Or maybe it's her eyes. Couldn't be her dimples, cause that she didn't have. There's gotta be something about her that I like so much. She gives me butterflies, the simple things. She sings me lullabies, deserves a ring. She feels like summertime, sometimes it rains. She snaps her fingers, now I'm having a perfect day. Oh, she's everything to me, and she deserves a ring. Oh, she's everything to me. Could talk for hours, fall asleep right on the sofa. Can stay up late on Friday nights, I guess we're getting older. See, every time is special, it don't matter what we do. Wake me up, I'm dreaming, I can't believe it's true. See, I could write a book and I could ramble on for hours. I'm awestruck, love struck, yeah, she's got the power. Lucky to have found the one who treats me like her king. It would be an honor to make her my queen, so. She gives me butterflies, the simple things. She sings me lullabies, deserves a ring. She feels like summertime, sometimes it rains. She snaps her fingers, now I'm having a perfect day. Oh, she's everything to me, and she deserves a ring. Everything to me, she's everything. Oh, she's everything to me, and she deserves a ring. Oh, she's everything to me.
Inside. Funky revolutions, funky.
Funky revolutions, funky.
Hey, hey, hey.
Funky revolutions,
whoa,
funky.
Oh, hey, hey, hey.
Funky revolutions, funky. You are listening to Funky Revolutions.
We see our clean.
For your mind and for your hip, this is the Mothership's Cassette Archives, 25 years of funky revolutions.
Wait a minute, that's too fast.
Now what?
Kick it over here, baby pop!